Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jar, and this is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited, the science podcast that's soft, strong, and very, very long. On this week's show, cosmologist and author Marcus Chown joins us in the pod. We'll be addressing the big questions about life, the universe, and everything in between. Plus, we discuss the ethics and politics of health economics with one of the country's foremost authorities on the subject. And we'll be taking a journey to the bottom of the sea, uncovering some of the mysteries of the colossal squid. Jules Verne ain't got nothing on us. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. You know, this week it's probably easier for me to list the absentees from the pod. James Randerson's still in Texas at a conference of forensic scientists. Ride 'em, cowboy. Bobby Johnson's in Brighton, busily moving house. And quite frankly, I've no idea where Ian Samples got to this week. So it's an extra large how-do to the First Lady of Science, Nell Bowes, from Guardian Unlimited's arts blog. And our producer, Ben Green, who did get a B in chemistry, GCSE. I think he cheated, though. Pod Squad, thank you for turning up.
Hello.
So, Nell and Ben aside, who else is going to sprinkle wisdom and insight into our science stories this week? Well, he's the cosmology correspondent for New Scientist and the author of a number of science books that are as entertaining as they are informative. His latest one's called The Never-Ending Days of Being Dead, in which he ponders the mysteries of existence. And he even asks whether this chap's alive and well, and possibly living in another space domain. This wouldn't be Science Weekly without a bit of music to get us going. Marcus Chown, welcome to the pod. Where is Elvis?
Well,
according to your book, he's not dead.
Absolutely not. It's an unavoidable consequence of the standard picture of physics, which is called quantum theory, and the standard picture of the universe, that in fact Elvis is not only alive and kicking, but is alive and kicking in an infinite number of other places in the universe.
So this is the idea that there are many, many universes around, and it's 100% likely that he's around somewhere. Is he going to produce the same music everywhere, or is he going to have the same quiff? Is he the same Elvis?
Well, this is all about all possible histories occurring somewhere, and this is really... The main idea is that according to the standard theory of cosmology, the universe is infinite in extent. It doesn't look infinite in extent. In fact, it has a horizon around it. We call it the observable universe, all that we can see. We can only see these galaxies within the observable universe because the universe began 14 billion years ago. So we can only see all the objects whose light has taken less than 14 billion years to get here. Those that would take 15 billion years, it's like the light is still on its way. So beyond this kind of bubble of the observable universe, there are an infinite number of other bubbles.
Does that mean that there is an edge to the universe? And if so, what is at the end of it?
Well, that's actually the question I asked. My book is about ultimate questions, and the first question I
asked,
leads to the Elvis idea, is that what is beyond the edge of the universe? And really, when we talk about the universe, we tend to talk about the observable universe. And again, it's because the universe began. We can only see the lights from objects whose light has had time to get here.
Do you come to any conclusions about what is at the edge of our bubble?
Well, other regions. Very similar to our own.
Are we like to meet this Elvis double? Is he going to? Can he somehow turn up in our universe?
Well, we can actually calculate how far away the nearest surviving Elvis is, and it's something like it's a fantastically large distance. But it's actually in pick a direction, it's in that direction. You can calculate how far away. As the time goes on, the horizon of the universe expands outwards because we can see objects which are further and further away because as the universe gets older, we can see, that their light has time to get here. So eventually, a region where Elvis survives would overlap with our region. However, by the time that happened, all of the stars would have gone out and Elvis would be long dead.
So all these different universes are all part of... this one, they're just further away beyond the observable horizon. It's not like they exist.
Absolutely right. We're talking about, this is concrete. We're not talking about any fiction about other universes in some place that we don't know where it is, in another dimension. We're actually talking about our concrete universe. Because according to our theory of the universe's birth, which is called inflation, the universe is infinite in extent. So we have this little bubble around us, which is the observable universe. that according to inflation, there are an infinite number of other bubbles, all containing galaxies and stars like ours. Now, the second point to know is the universe is quantum, which means if you were to look at space with a super microscope, it would look grainy. It would look like a chessboard. And just as you can only arrange the pieces on a chessboard in a finite number of ways, you can only arrange the matter in the universe in a finite number of ways. So when you think about...
You've got an infinite amount of matter within the universe.
There isn't an infinite amount of...
Right.
The universe is finite in size, the observable universe. So the whole point is there is an infinite number of these bubbles, very much like our observable universe, but only a finite number of ways to arrange the matter. So the Big Bangs, which will have occurred in all these other regions...
They've all had Big Bangs, all these individuals.
Essentially the same Big Bang.
Yeah.
So the galaxies that would have formed would have been all slightly different in all of these regions. But the point, again, is that there are an infinite number of these regions, but only a finite number of arrangements of the matter. So only a finite number of histories. So there's an infinite number of places where the Germans, won the Second World War, an infinite number of places where the dinosaurs were not wiped out by an asteroid, but
and an infinite number of places where the cosmological constant is different, or...
That's a good point.
That's a good point. Are the laws of physics the same?
Because one of the biggest mysteries in science at the moment is that the expansion of the universe is speeding up. And we only discovered this surprisingly in 1998. We believe that there is this stuff called dark energy, which fills all of empty space. It has repulsive gravity. And its repulsive gravity is speeding up the expansion of the universe. But one of the mysteries of this dark energy is that our best theory of physics, quantum theory, when we use it to predict what the energy of empty space should be, it fails to do it by a factor of 1 followed by 123 zeros. So
good.
Our best theory of physics overestimates the energy of the vacuum by 1 followed by 123 zeros. This is the biggest discrepancy between an observation and a prediction in the history of science.
Well, we let our listeners get their brains around that. We'll give them a rest. Marcus is going to stick around for the rest of the show, so don't go anywhere. But we'll be hearing more from him in a sec. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, why drinking a spearmint tea can make a lady less hairy. Yes, really. Plus, thousands of calamari rings the size of tractor tyres. We'll tell you about the amazing catch made by fishermen in New Zealand. That is all coming up, but first, one of the most interesting stories to come out of the AAAS show in San Francisco last week was the news that researchers are about to step up their work in the field of sight restoration. This is down to the success of a trial in which a so-called bionic eye was surgically implanted into a blind patient's retina. So far, 6 people in the trial have had their sight partially restored, so it's been announced that a new study will begin into a more sophisticated version of the technology, with between 50 and 75 patients taking part. Our man James Randerson covered the conference for The Guardian, and he caught up with Mark Humayun from the University of Southern California, who told him about the advances in bionic eyes.
The retinal implants that are already in 6 patients and for 3 or 5 years consist of glasses with a tiny camera on them, and then a pocket-worn BlackBerry or pager-sized device, which in real time does the digital signal processing and also has batteries. Information from the glasses goes to this pocket-worn device, and then from there it goes wirelessly into the implant. The implant receives the information, stimulates the nerve cells of the retina through tiny electrodes, and by doing so, effectively hooks up the blind patient to the camera. Currently, the device has 16 electrodes, or 16 pixels, 16 spots that are created by this device. So imagine a 4x4 a pixel array. For you and me, we couldn't do much with it other than to be able to tell maybe light from dark, but the subjects can use this device amazingly well. One of the things we found out is that the brain is able to fill in a lot of the missing information. So for instance, with time and with use of the device, the subjects can differentiate between a plate, a cup, and a knife in a test environment. They can differentiate movement in front of them as to which way a person move. They can also tell where the door is, and also be able to tell where the tables and chairs are. So we're very excited about what these subjects can do and how much the human brain and the plasticity of the human brain can fill in the vision that's otherwise not necessarily provided by the implant.
And some of these subjects have been blind for decades. Were you surprised at how much they were able to do?
Yes, these subjects have been blind for 50 years, 30 years, so many, many decades. And we didn't know how they were going to take to this device, how well they were going to be able to use it, how much they could remember about their vision. But the human brain, majority of it, or a very large part of it, is dedicated to vision, the cortex part of it. And so it wants that input. It desires that input. And so what we've seen is, in fact, that the brain accepts this, accommodates it, and uses it very readily.
And just lastly, I understand you've been working with Stevie Wonder. What's his involvement?
Stevie Wonder is a patient of mine and a friend of mine. And he's very, very much for really raising awareness of this technology so people can get to listen, hear about it, understand it. Because in medicine, you normally think of drugs, you normally think of surgery, you don't think of microelectronics restoring sight. So in that way, he's been a good spokesman to raise the awareness for this sort of technology towards blindness.
And is he a potential recipient, or does he have a different kind of blindness?
Stevie Wonder has been blind pretty much since childhood, and so that's a more difficult type of blindness. We're not saying that the device will not help him. In the cochlear implant for the deaf, patients who have been deaf and early in their life still get some benefit, but not as much as if you were deafened much later. So I think the jury's still out. I don't think it'll be as effective as somebody who had vision into their 20s and 30s and 40s. But we never know, and so it's definitely a population that we will eventually try.
That was James Randerson speaking to Mark Humayun from the University of Southern California. Well, as ever, we want to know what you think out there in Podland about this topic. Are bionic eyes and limbs the way forward? Is this the science fiction of the future? Email us at science@guardian.co.uk or post a blog, guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. Right, now time for a roundup of the other news making the headlines from the world of science and tech. A quick production meeting resulted in the decision that news marmalade doesn't quite cut the mustard. So here we go with news jam. I'm going to start us off. It's the thorny issue of egg donation. So the HFEA, which is the government's fertility watchdog, this week announced that it would allow women to altruistically donate eggs, which could then be fertilised to create embryos and which we could then extract stem cells from. I mean, people who were worried about genetics and so on get worried that this is going to cause all sorts of cloned humans, human hybrids, all sorts of things. What do you guys in the pod think? Nell, did you think this is a totally unethical thing to do?
I'm not sure that it's so much the problem of what happens to the eggs, but the problem of making sure that you're not putting pressure on people. And so you want to recompense someone for the pain of donating eggs, but you don't want to put pressure on people who are financially pressured to feel that this is something that they want to do purely for financial reward.
Okay, well, we'll move straight on to the next thing. From something deeply ethical and complicated to something else, which I'm not sure how serious this is, but Nell, this is a tea issue.
I don't think it's very serious at all, but it is about tea.
which is why it's in there.
Silly story this week about a bunch of guys from Turkey, a bunch of researchers who got a score of women to drink spearmint tea. And found that it decreased the amount of active testosterone floating around in their bloodstream.
And
it's thought that women with higher than normal levels of male hormones suffer from hirsutism or hairiness, and therefore if you can decrease the amount of testosterone floating around, then you're likely to be less hairy, which...
I have to say, I'm a big fan of peppermint tea, and I'm very hairy, so I'm not quite sure.
Well, I'd say there are only 21 people in the study, so I'm not sure it isn't entirely.
Look, this has become a bit of a tradition now. Marcus, how do you take your tea?
With milk and without sugar.
Any particular type of tea?
I mean, Typhoo, is that...
That's perfectly fine.
Are you a dunker?
Do you dunk? Yes.
I do, actually. Is that a bad thing?
Well, we have no opinions of that sort on this.
The French just like to know. Donuts and things,
we just
don't
like
they?
To know. I think Croissants. We can publish this data at some point. And that was the news jam. The issue of health economics has been in the news again over the past week after it was revealed that the Department of Health and some of the UK's major pharmaceutical companies fixed the prices for a number of drugs available on the NHS. The discovery is likely to result in a more transparent system of medicine pricing, or at least we hope, and that could lead to lower prices for prohibitively expensive drugs like Herceptin. So, is it right to put a price on someone's life? Alan Maynard's a professor of health economics at the University of York, and we can speak to him right now. Alan, thank you for joining us. Let me put the question to you straight. Why can't I just get any drug that I need if it's proved to work?
Because we simply haven't got enough money in the NHS. We've got $80 billion to spend, but the drug costs are very high and technology is changing. And the challenge is really to identify where the drugs work in relation to their costs. So everything can't be afforded. It's not a question of whether we ration. The question is how we ration.
And so things like Herceptin, for example, they were not initially recommended by NICE. Why was that?
Well, initially there was a great deal of controversy with regard to Herceptin because people were wanting to introduce it before the results of the clinical trials were in, and we didn't even know whether it worked, and it hadn't gone through safety and efficacy controls. So it was a very expensive drug. It works for a range of patients, but we have to balance the benefits we get from that drug and its costs with other things like people waiting for hips, people waiting for heart surgery, and it's balancing those priorities, which is the great difficulty.
So how do you actually end up doing this? Is there a sort of economic tool that sort of scientists can use to, or regulators can use to sort of put this into numbers?
Yes, I mean, economic evaluation is about saying, well, how much do you give up in terms of cost, and what do you gain in terms of increases in the length and quality of life? So what we're really trying to do is to get the pharmaceutical industry to be much more precise in its clinical trials in measuring increases in the length of life from cancer drugs or whatever, and increases in quality. And then these are sort of melded in a crude fashion into a composite measure, which is called a quality-adjusted life year, or a QALY. And this is really an attempt to say, that is, how many of these units do we get of 1 year of life of good mental and physical functioning for patients, and is it worth buying?
There's something slightly sort of macabre and a bit sort of crowing about this whole thing. I wonder, you know, is this the only way we can get to sort of measure the effectiveness of drugs? I mean, to people who might see this as creepy almost.
Okay, well, this has been done. This is adopted as best practice by the National Institute of Clinical Excellence since 1999, and other people do it as well. It's the best thing you can do. It's explicit. It's demanding that the industry give their best estimates of what the benefits and what the costs are, and it really challenges the industry to, A, show that their drugs work, and, B, to be moderate in their pricing. I mean, this week's controversy is over the fact that the industry is charging very high prices for drugs which give only marginal benefits to patients. But their PR is so effective that it's often very difficult to counter them and say, well, it'd be much better to spend the money elsewhere rather than on these marginal drugs.
Okay, well, Alan Maynard, thank you very much for speaking with us. Well, that was Alan Maynard of the University of York. Marcus, you were nodding during that interview. What do you make of the quality of life years and so on?
Well, I mean, I agree with that way of judging drugs. I mean, there's a lot of publicity about drugs and how certain people can't get them, but somebody has to make a decision, and this is NICE in this country, about which drugs actually do work and are most effective. And for 60 million people, this is, you know, a decision has to be made for 60 million people by the NHS. You know, we can't really have many drugs which are very expensive and, as you say, don't have much effect.
Well, we'd love to know your thoughts too, listeners, so send us an email at science@guardian.co.uk. And now, as they say, for something completely different. Wonderful things around you, one more issue looking for. We're not playing that song from Little Mermaid because I'm a sucker for Disney, although I think that producer Ben is. No, it's because last week, fishermen in New Zealand were, to put it mildly, a little surprised to find their nets bulging with one of the rarest creatures on Earth. I'm not going to try and say the Latin name of this because I'll just get it wrong. It was a colossal squid, about 10 metres long and weighed around 450 kilograms. That's 71 stone, old money. And if the squid could talk, he would probably confirm that it's indeed better down where it's wetter. So what makes this an exciting discovery? Well, I'll tell you. this is one of the rarest animals ever. The second only example of this particular thing that's been caught in whole. The last one was a 300-kilogram immature female. These things have amazing eyes. It's the size of dinner plates. They're the biggest in the animal kingdom, apparently. And the researchers in question were saying that if you cut this thing up, then the calamari would be the size of tractor tyres. Now, tell me that doesn't excite you both in this pod now.
Well, it doesn't excite me that much, but I think it's rather sad. But you just mentioned their eyes, and aren't they? They're supposed to be fantastic. I know, as someone who did astronomy, that X-ray astronomers actually build their X-ray telescopes modelled on the squid's eye.
How?
Well, I believe their eyes contain lots and lots of parallel channels that channel the light, and that's the only way you can focus X-rays, because X-rays are not deflected by mirrors. So this is how they build the X-ray telescopes, to look for the X-rays produced by black holes and neutrons. On stars and supernovae and all this kind of stuff. Thanks to the squid.
I love the fact that it all comes down to cosmology in the end. Nell, come on.
Great. I remember, it's so excited. I remember when they had the photos of real live giant squid come in, I think last year sometime, and you could just see this sort of looming shape in the blackness, and they'd gone down hundreds and hundreds of metres and actually managed to lure one of these things into triggering the camera that they'd got. Mm-hmm. And
it's terrifying.
Fantastic.
It's the whole thing about ships being sunk in stories of ye old.
These huge colossal squids coming up and clasping around them in the classic B-movie fashion.
In this case, the squid was already dead by the time it came up.
It may actually happen. But, and they're supposed to be incredibly intelligent, aren't they, as well? I do feel sorry for the thing. You know, we can only think about turning them into calamari.
Well, what do they eat?
Well, there's very little known about these animals because researchers in the past have only really had bits of them, tentacles, maybe a bit of stomach, that kind of thing. And the idea is, I think I spoke to a researcher at the Natural History Museum, suggested that these squids eat smaller squids and fish.
Classic.
In fact, it was actually eating a toothfish when it was caught in the nets of these fishermen. And I believe it was on its way out.
Did they catch it? Was it much higher than normal?
I think it must have been, and it must have got trapped in one of the nets, and unfortunately died as it came up to the surface. So I'm hoping they didn't kill it on its way up. That would be that would be annoying. It wasn't a great day, no. Right, we're almost done for this week's show, but before we go, I want to return to our special guest, Marcus Chown, and find out a little more about the ideas in his brand spanking new book, The Neverending Days of Being Dead. Available in all good bookshops now, I'm assuming, Marcus?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, listen, another thing I noticed in my speed read of the book is that perhaps we're all part of a computer program, according to one of your chapters.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is an idea of a physicist called Stephen Wolfram, who's from London. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars because he invented a computer language called Mathematica. And in the early 1980s, he was playing on one of the first PCs, and he was trying to understand complexity, the complexity of biology and the complexity of galaxies. And he knew that mathematical physics isn't able to describe these systems, so he started using computer programs. He thought maybe he could have a physics based on computer programs which have rules rather than mathematical equations. And he started seeing what simple computer programs could do. He would actually run them, and he would feed back the output into the input and do that over and over again. He discovered, amazingly, that very, very simple computer programs, we call them cellular automata, sometimes have an infinitely complex output, so it never ever, what comes out never ever repeats. And this was very striking. He suddenly thought to himself, is this what biology is doing? You know, is this what the universe is doing? Is this how it creates the complexity of a rose or your face or a galaxy? And he's worked through this idea. He produced a book a couple of years ago, which was very controversial, called A New Kind of Science. He does believe he's the new Newton. And he believes that the universe is being generated by a computer program 4 lines long in his own language, Mathematica.
So let's unpack some of that. We'll get back to the new Newton thing in a second. But this book, A New Kind of Science, it was a weighty thing, isn't it? It was 1,000-odd pages long. It caused a massive backlash. Scientists around the world weren't necessarily happy with it, were they?
Sometimes the response of the scientific community is emotional when it should be more rational. And one of the striking things about this book, which contains no equations, no mathematics, it contains just pictures.
Is he saying that the equation-based thing is wrong? Or?
No, he's not. He's saying that the universe is generating complexity by running computer programs. And most of those computer programs are what's called computationally irreducible. In other words, you can only find out the consequence by running the program. However, a subset of those computer programs are computationally reducible. So in other words, you can predict what the output will be more quickly than running a program, and that is what physics does. So this physics is the subset of the universe which is predictable.
So this is all very Douglas Adams and deep thought, isn't it?
Extremely Douglas Adams, because it could be that the universe, the purpose of the universe is a computer program whose output cannot be figured out without running a computer program for 14 billion years.
Work that one out, Nell. You've got a question.
I've forgotten what my question was.
And I'm not surprised.
All right, well, let me ask you another question then.
Yeah.
Marcus, can I just go take you, just to finish up, can I take you right back to one of the first things we talked about on this multiple universe hypothesis? If there's multiple universes, lots of Earths, I'm assuming lots of versions of this podcast where things go right once in a while. Does that mean that we just... What about all these ethical issues we face? We talked about stem cells and donating embryos before. We've got climate change. We've got all sorts of things, animal experiments. I mean, somewhere, whatever we decide, somewhere someone's going to do the opposite. So you could go mad thinking about that.
That's a very, very interesting question. The first thing I want to say is, of course, the existence of these multiple infinite number of copies of us is dependent on quantum theory and a standard picture of the universe being correct. Okay, so if either of those is incorrect, and most people think they are correct, but if either of those is incorrect, then there aren't these infinite number of copies. But as you rightly point out, there are moral questions. I mean, what is the point of fighting evil? Defeating the Nazis is if in an infinite number of other places in the universe they prevail. As you also mentioned, things like global warming. What is the point of solving global warming if it is solved in many other places? Well, the answer, of course, is that we cannot really worry about these other places. You know, we have to try and forget them, and we have to worry about our own lives. And we have to solve these problems and fight evil and solve the problem of global warming for ourselves.
So you're saying that we can't use this as an excuse not to do anything?
In the history of science, we've discovered that we're less and less special. We discovered that we were not the centre of the universe. Darwin showed us that we were not the centre of creation. Now it seems that cosmology is telling us that there's nothing special about our civilization and about the Earth. It's repeated...
Or our decisions.
Exactly. They're repeated an infinite number of other times throughout the universe.
And on that bombshell, I'm going to take a deep breath and just think about all this for a while. Ben, play a sting or something. Okay, well, that's it for this week's programme. If you want to comment on anything you've heard on the show, email us at science@guardian.co.uk, or remember the blog at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts, where, incidentally, you'll find every show we've ever done, and some of them ain't half bad. So that just leaves me to thank everyone in the pod. That's Nell Bowes and our special guest, Marcus Chown. Find out more about him at marcuschown.com. Buy his new book. All the details are on our website. Science Weekly is produced by Ben Green. I've been Alok Jar. See you next time.
Guardian Unlimited.